are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Oh, it is, excuse me, it is Monday, September 12th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a commie news roundup with my favorite commie, hashtag Trini Commie, Bhaskara Sankara, the founder of Jacobin Magazine. We're going to be talking about the Labour leadership election in the UK and the future of the left in that country as Jeremy Corbyn looks set to continue his leadership of the UK Labour Party. And we'll talk about moralism and voting in the United States. What would an ideal third party look like here? And how do we build one from a radical perspective? Also, Hillary Clinton is dying. They were right. We were all lying. It's amazing, but you can't hide the truth. Or maybe you're doing a grueling schedule that most people of pretty much any age would have trouble doing, and it was hot and humid in New York City, and you're standing in a hot suit, and you have walking pneumonia, and so you get sick, and then you get some antibiotics, and you'll be fine. There's no antibiotics for what Donald Trump has, folks. It's true. U.S. and Russia.
Maybe, sorry about that. Oh, maybe for
Matt
someone
was like, hold on, bring the music
down. I got
down.
A joke. Maybe, I got it. Maybe for some of what Trump has.
Oh, maybe so. Maybe so. Anyways, I was rolling there, but Matt has a joke, so I love that. U.S. and Russia have, no, that's fine. I think once you've cut the music, you can't go back to it. The United States and Russia have announced the ceasefire, a new ceasefire for Syria, and a joint air command to take on terrorists. What is that going to look like in practice? The Egyptian revolution from several years ago, you know that it was secretly really a labor revolution, and General Sisi, the new dictator of that country, is cracking down on labor and real victory in North Dakota as the administration suspends construction of that pipeline, and also a bunch of sound, which I don't have in front of me. Did you give me that sound, Matt? Do you have any jokes that you'd like to put in here while I'm looking for sound? Okay, Kelly, is it a joke?
No, it's not
okay.
A joke.
Okay, no, I just want to know what I'm dealing
and
with.
And I don't preface.
Yeah, I like that. That's true.
And I don't really make many jokes, but if I just want to say at the top of the show, if you're not subscribed to the YouTube channel, why?
Do it.
Ask yourself that question, because we have clips of most of our sound, and it's even funnier when there is also video, and we're trying to get to 100,000 subscribers, and if we do, then Sam's giving us all raises. I made that up. That last
I was going to say.
Yeah.
All of a sudden,
sorry.
I think that this is actually a serious thing that I care, a goal that I care about accomplishing.
I might get a raise.
Now it's,
but
all right. Well, you know, do what you do. Do what you feel. You also can get extra content from me. Those videos are fun. Those Majority X segments.
His own
so
series.
There's all sorts of other stuff that you get if you subscribe to the YouTube channel. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. Last week on Thursday, we had my friend Anthony Lappi, who's the executive producer of Black Market on Viceland. And I was just thinking, because everybody's freaking out watching the second season of Narcos. And once again, Two Dope Boys is ahead of the curve, giving you a deep conversation on how the drug trade is working, the global economy, endangered species trafficking, and you know, getting to it in our particular Dope Boy style. More great feedback on it over the weekend. Subscribe to it, please. Two Dope Boys and a Podcast on iTunes. It's the number 2 Dope Boys and a Podcast on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher. Folks, Harry's. What more can you say about Harry's? They're simply the best. If you're in the shaving game, you need a Harry's razor. It's true. I'm totally. If you're in the shaving game, you need a Harry's razor.
I play the shaving game every other morning.
God, stop being funny today.
Look, you need to stop compromising your shave and get started with Harry's. For far too long, you've either paid too much for a comfortable shave or you've settled for a low price but low quality razor. Harry's offers you something you never had before, a great shave for a fair price. Harry's makes its own high quality razors and cuts out the middleman. Ships them to you directly for half the price of the leading brand. Good shave, good price. It's simple. Get the best of both with Harry's. Harry's is the only shaving company that has both amazing quality and low prices. Literally, I mean, every time I shave, I use Harry's. It does feel liberating to never have to go to the drugstore again and buy an overpriced razor. And that whole process, it's a waste of time and money. It's factory direct prices. Cuts out the middleman, no upcharges, half the price of the leading brand. And the Harry starter set called the Truman is a great option for new customers and an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 of Harry's 5-blade German-engineered razors. But there's a special offer now for fans of the Majority Report. Harry's will give you 5 off of your first purchase with promo code MAJORITYREPORT. That's harrys.com right now and look for the Truman set. That's harrys.com, harrys.com. Enter promo code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout and get $5 off and help support the show now. Stop compromising and give Harry's a try. That's promo code MAJORITYREPORT, harrys.com. Link to it on the blog. Matt will put it up there. We will be right back with Bhaskar Sankara. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. I thought that was the clean version. I guess we'll cut that out. Joining us now is Bhaskar Sankara. He is the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine. Bhaskar, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Pleased to be on again. I think this is number maybe 5. I don't know. I'm getting up there.
You're getting up there. You're becoming, I think it's like, I see it as sort of like the communist meet the press segment with you, basically.
I actually prefer the communist, what's the name of that other show? McLaughlin Report or whatever?
McLaughlin. Wrong!
The guy's like 92.
Wrong! I think, isn't that what he used to say? He just passed away recently, actually. Didn't he just pass away?
Bye-bye.
Well,
that was poorly timed then.
Yeah.
Well. It clearly made a deep imprint on my life. I actually used to spend a lot of my Sunday mornings doing that instead of watching cartoons as a kid. So,
Say no more, Bhaskar. That actually literally does explain everything. Although I wonder how, well, another time we'll explain where the good politics came from. But let's first touch on this leadership election in the UK, because it offers a window into really, you know, basically having a major industrial political party, which could become and is potentially in the process of being very, very radicalized and having some genuine radical politics. I think There's electoral questions about Jeremy Corbyn's viability as prime minister, which we have to be kind of intellectually honest about. But it does look like, in spite of another attempt by the Labour establishment to remove him from office, and a new thing that broke this morning, which we'll touch on, he's on his way to being reelected as Labour leader. What does that mean for where the Labour Party heads from here and the sort of more genuinely radical-ish agenda that they're going to start to follow or are following already?
Well, listen, we have to be perfectly honest here. The Labour Party is in a tough position as far as head-to-head matchups,
yep.
and especially with their heartlands in Scotland going for the SNP and, you know, other breakdowns that have happened in British politics. It's hard to imagine kind of a Labour pathway to victory in the next election. If it does happen, it'll be through a very, very narrow minority government. And this is actually a lot of the opponents of Corbyn. This is what they point out. Listen, you know, we're in a situation where we might lose the country to the right for a generation if the party moves along this kind of dangerous left-wing direction. The problem with that logic is that people have fled the Labour Party partially because not because they're all of a sudden voting for UKIP or the Tories or whatnot. They're leaving the Labour Party because they don't feel like it represents their interests. Mm-hmm. They felt like under Tony Blair, under others, the party had fundamentally changed from a party of that represented the interests of British workers to one that represented, you know, just another segment of the elite. Mm-hmm. And what Jeremy Corbyn's doing is really rebuilding some sort of base and some sort of infrastructure for the party. A lot of his activist base, a lot of people you see real visible supporting Jeremy Corbyn are young working class kids. But behind the scenes and less visible, I think, for us on the outside, is a tremendous amount of support that he's gotten from the unions. There's mm-hmm. no way he would have made it to the ballot last year without the unions. There's no right. way he'd be ahead so far in the polls in this race without pretty strong and stable union support. So I really think that, you know, between that core base of support and the fact that the Labour membership is surging, it's now the largest party in Western Europe. It has 600,000 members. This is up from, you know, just between, I think, like 100,000 and 200,000 before Corbyn emerged. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is the creation of a long-term base that will one day be able to do really, you know, I think important things in British politics. But that doesn't mean that the right doesn't have a point about the next election. My point is just that the right would be in even worse shape than Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, let's get
the right of the Labour Party, that is.
Yeah, no, I understand the right of the Labour Party, right? That's a good distinction. So then let's actually ask a kind of more superficial question to get back to these deeper themes. When you make that point, let's sort of, you know, for people that don't know, I know a lot of people will know, but essentially Jeremy Corbyn's been empowering the Labour Party for about a year, right out
exactly
of the gate.
Exactly a year today. Actually.
Exactly a year today, excuse me, rather. Exactly a year today. When he first came into power, you know, it was very unexpected. It was almost, I mean, even though all of the polls for a long time had showed him leading, it was almost sort of like, you know, Brexit inside the Labour Party almost. It really shocked the elites of the party. And you went from having, you know, Tony Blair, who obviously is a kind of distinct figure, to Gordon Brown, who I think is certainly, you could be a little bit more charitable to him in some ways than Blair, but certainly represents the right of the party. Then you had Ed Miliband, who was moving more towards the kind of soft left. And then we have, you know, Jeremy Corbyn really actually on the left. And the party has resisted an attempt to undermine him every step of the way. There, you know, there was a no confidence vote among Labour MPs, and now we're in another leadership election, which Corbyn is, you know, almost certain to win against a guy named Owen Smith. And this is my question, Bhaskar, is it seems to me that, you know, what is lost from so much of this conversation is that people on sort of every side, on the right side of Labour to the left, they want to kind of claim that this is about policy and issues. And I think that that in some respects, what all of these candidates share since Tony Blair, from, you know, Jeremy Corbyn to Gordon Brown, is they're just simply they're not as good at sort of politics in some ways. I think Tony Blair would maybe be too slick in today's environment. People want a little bit less of that, a little bit less polish. But, you know, Ed Miliband ran, I think, electorally a pretty persuasive argument, but he couldn't, you know, he just wasn't a great candidate. You know, it was kind of awkward. And I wonder, like, to what extent do you think, you know, use this as an opportunity to maybe talk about Owen Smith and the guy who's challenging Corbyn. It's like, what extent is what holding Corbyn back has nothing to do with whether his politics are too radical or this or that. Maybe just that he hasn't, you know, been sharp enough at prime minister's questions. Maybe that he doesn't have a certain kind of style that is, you know, favored in today's electoral environment. I mean, does that make sense? Use the more kind of optics stuff to get us to the deeper stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think to a certain degree, Jeremy Corbyn is not a conventionally, you know, sharp politician. Even when he's at his best, he's often, when he's giving speeches, he's reading from, you know, a piece of paper. Right. He's, you would think the Labour Party would at least invest in some teleprompters after, you know, decades of being in power. But, you know, so, but I actually think to some degree, this reminds me of, you know, the concept of the uncanny valley?
No.
So basically, it's a concept that I'm probably butchering right now, and you'll probably get a few reader, listener responses. Right,
there is no question that we will get reader, listener responses about this.
But essentially, yeah. It's the idea that, like, say, if you're doing, you know, graphics for a movie that's entirely, you know, CGI or whatever, or you're playing a video game or something, there's a certain point where or, you know, same thing with, like, robots that look really like, you know, very much like humans. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, the design keeps getting better and better and better, and it starts looking more and more like humans and people like that. But then you reach some certain point where it looks really close to being human, but you could still detect that it's not real life. They're not real actors, or it's not a real robot or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's an immediate feeling of revulsion.
So it's like Blade Runner, almost.
Yeah, something like that. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think in many ways, there is now a kind of revulsion against the very slick, overly polished,
right,
overly kind of focus group, third way style of politics.
Yeah, or establishment too glib,
style
yeah.
of politics in mm-hmm. general. Mm-hmm. So people like Trump, you know, they like him because he seems like honest and no BS, even if he's contradictory or whatever. So he can't get caught in the same kind of gaffes that would cripple another candidate. Mm-hmm. People like Sanders because he wasn't polished. I think to some degree, a lot of the support for Jeremy Corbyn just comes from people being like, he seems like a nice guy. You know, he seems right. like someone who is a regular person who just happens to be, you know, involved in politics. So I think if anything, he's a perfect type of candidate. There's no doubt the Labour Party can improve the way they respond to you know, these press attacks against them and so on and so on. But I think he fits this kind of mold and this sentiment and feeling that people have, this broadly anti-establishment feeling. And if not for Jeremy Corbyn, can you just imagine for a minute what British politics would look like? You would have UKIP as the only insurgent, the only you know, force in England that represents some sort of anti-establishment politics.
Right.
It'd be absolutely
right.
ridiculous. So right. the fact that people are all complaining, especially in the Labour Party, I think complaining erroneously, that, oh, Jeremy Corbyn in his heart of hearts was for Leave, and his inner circle were all secretly for Leave. That's why they didn't campaign hard enough for Remain. Well, guess what? Leave won. So how is that necessarily, you know, a terrible thing? The fact that the leader of the Labour Party might share and harbor some sentiments that the, you know, a good chunk of the British, you know, electorate agrees with.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I really think that he's in many ways the best of the Labour Party can put out at the moment. And really the process that's going on, like building in communities, turning these constituency Labour parties into like actual places of debate, looping in all these segments of people that were alienated from the Labour Party, getting in a generation of young people who see the Labour Party as their own party and not the party of the Iraq War, not the party of, you know, junior partner of U.S. imperialism.
Right.
You know, I think this is all a very good thing in the long term. And I honestly think that that a lot of people opposing Jeremy Corbyn within the Labour Party, to the extent we could assign kind of good faith arguments to them, they're thinking too short term about the next election. And obviously a lot of them are thinking about their own, you know, jobs, their own careers, their own networks and whatnot, getting
some of them were thinking about not wanting, you know, Jeremy Corbyn to respond to the findings of the Chilcot inquiry and having, you know, a leader of the Labour Party, you know, correctly represent what happened with the Blair's government and, you know, their role in hyping and rushing and, you know, in the invasion of Iraq. So, I mean, there's no doubt about that. So before we move off of the UK then, Bhaskar, you mentioned the long term. And there is something, right? So this is very distinct. You have these different ripples. I mean, obviously, in an American context, the whole, even more than the UK, the whole political sort of center of gravity is still significantly to the right. But you obviously had the success of Sanders running this incredible insurgency and redefining some of the terms. Then, you know, in places like Spain and Greece, to greater and lesser success. But we have seen these alternatives to traditional social democratic parties, Podemos and Syriza. But this is distinct. A traditional center-left party that has always contained, I mean, you know, Blair might have been the kind of most extreme rightward movement of the party in some ways, although, you know, people forget when they first came to power, this is someone who still, you know, introduced minimum wage, expanded NHS funding. So, you know, again, there still is just some kind of constituent realities of political parties, which we shouldn't forget. But to have the actual left take this party over is certainly at least unprecedented, maybe at least since the early 80s, if not, you know, more so, though certainly that didn't end electorally well. But what does it mean to have, you know, the UK of the special relationship, the UK of a major industrial democracy, you know, not to have the political space where the main opposition party is genuinely of the left? What does that mean for the UK and beyond?
Well, here's one thing that's really significant. So the Labour Party has always had left current. It's always had parts of the party that were pushing. And this is a tradition that Jeremy Corbyn comes from, this kind of Tony Benn tradition on the Labour left. But even when the Labour Party has had leaderships that have adopted left-wing policies, they've always conceived of politics in a very parliamentary mode.
Mm-hmm.
What Jeremy Corbyn brings about and what he's been pushing is this vision of the party as the incubator of social movements, as a party as helping to encourage movement from below. Sometimes movements are messy and hard to kind of define or pin down or contain. And I think this is a fundamental break with the politics of the traditional Labour Party. And it seems to some people, like a shocking abandonment of this parliamentary road that's given British workers so many basic rights, like the NHS, like the, you know, like an 8-hour day, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But in an era when social democracy has been so hollowed out since the mid-1970s,
it
actually makes sense as a conception of politics. This social democracy 2.0 has to be different than the initial social democracy because it has to come from below and it has to have new mechanisms of popular mobilization to push these men. Because it's one thing to convince capital to break off a little bit more money, a little bit, some other demands, some new regulations in the 50s and 60s when they're making tons of money, when things seem like they're going up and up,
right,
and where there's actually a huge cost. You know, right now, if me and you are working in a factory in Britain, you know, if we want to go on a 2-day strike, you know, our bosses might say, you know what? Setting the precedent of giving in to any of your demands, you know, I'd rather take the economic hit. Whereas if things are going great in the 50s and 60s, you know, you might be so profitable, it might actually, you know, make sense to give in to these demands. And of course, the unions are stronger than too. So
right. It's
completely new terrain. And I think that's important. But why are you seeing within the Labour Party and not within an outside formation? Like the left has always pushed these things with left unity and all these other efforts, saying the Labour Party has gone totally Blair-eyed, it can't be reclaimed, and so on and so on. I think it's just simply a matter of structure. I mean, if you look at the structure of how British elections work, it fuels a kind of two-party system. Mm-hmm. So people are going to have to kind of bore from within and try to change from within. And this was the strategy of the labor left. This was the strategy of people like John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn. Mm-hmm. And I think it's paid off and it's vindicated. And people like me on the left who were saying maybe there's more hope in things like left unity. People like me on the left who thought the labor left were just an anachronism, you know, about to go away within a generation. We've been completely proven wrong.
Right.
So I think one important thing for listeners to remember, though, is that the Labor Party is fundamentally, even when it went Blairite, it's still a party rooted and funded by unions and rooted in working class communities in a way that it doesn't reflect or mirror the structure of the Democratic Party. So right. I don't think any of these arguments are to say that we could bum rush the Democratic Party from kind of within the way that, that they did, in the UK.
Yeah, let's get to that. And the other irony is that, the Miliband brothers who, Ed Miliband, the former leader, and his brother David, who are, I would say a bit different. Miliband's a little bit more, I say, like on the soft left, and Ed Miliband more on the soft left. David Miliband, I think, more to the right. Their father was a great, Marxist scholar who wrote, I think it was Parliamentary Socialism, where he critiqued the whole idea of sort of labor being represented through the Labor Party in Parliament, and then both of his sons became mainstream labor politicians. So screw you, Dad. But anyways,
I'd be happy with that.
Yeah, yeah.
As long as my kid wasn't a Tory or wasn't a Reaganite, I'd be happy enough with center left. Maybe not David, but I'd be happy enough for it.
You'd be all right with Ed. I don't know if you would be. Yeah, I don't know. Tony Blair might be a test for you, Bhaskar. But regardless, right. so when we come to America, there's a couple of different aspects I want to, and we've had, we're not going to kind of relitigate the whole Bernie or bust thing, but I think that there's a couple of different aspects of this that are kind of more relevant to point to. The first is, I guess, the sort of the argument that maybe puts more pressure on, people like me who certainly think like, yeah, you have to, this is a no-brainer. You have to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I know that that's not what you're arguing against. But when you say that the Democratic Party can't be bum-rushed in the same way as the Labor Party, I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is you talk about social democracy 2.0. Well, what about social democracy 2.0 in a country that's never really had any type of significant social democracy? I mean, obviously, there's a New Deal infrastructure and some great society, but we're still, well behind the rest of the industrialized world and even just in terms of kind of basic social contract. So why is the Democratic Party, what's the problem with that bum rush approach? Explain the power dynamics of the Democrats.
Right. So one thing is, remember that the Democratic Party is a party based upon, funded by different investor blocks, mm-hmm. right? So in this election, it is, I think, significant that all the major sectors of capital, maybe besides for a few particularly reckless folks in the fossil fuel industry, will be backing the Democratic Party, right? That alone doesn't tell us anything, but I think the structure of the party is built around getting a funding base from these big donors and reflecting the interests of certain segments of capital once they're in power, in addition to also being pressured and occasionally giving concessions to workers. So a lot of this depends on the moment, right? Mm-hmm. So when the New Deal happened, people forget, and they think of, let's say, something like Big Oil. It's like, oh, Big Oil, that's Bush, that's a Republican. Big Oil was actually one of the biggest parts of the Democratic coalition mm-hmm. from the time of the New Deal up until the early 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So that might seem counterintuitive. You might be like, why in the world would Big Oil support a party that's certainly to the left of the Republican Party and certain of its economic programs and platforms and whatnot?
Right.
One thing is, labor is very capital intensive. Big Oil is very capital intensive,
yeah.
right? They could afford to give away some higher wages and some concessions here and there, but there was other aspects of their policies that the Democratic Party were able to adequately represent. All this is to say, this is very different than the dynamics that happens within a labor party. It's different because they're built structurally different. They have a different relationship to unions. They have a different relationship with work to working class communities. So one of it is it just I think of it this way: the labor movement and workers in the United States were able to build a semblance of a welfare state, the semblance mm-hmm. of the Labor Party within the Democratic Party.
Right.
But structurally, it was so different that as soon as it came time to cut and roll back and to change policies, it was that constituency that was most vulnerable because the party, you know, wasn't relying on it. Now, that's not to say that the Democratic ballot line can't be used in by the left tactically at certain moments. I thought Bernie Sanders was someone I supported. I supported that run. I think in certain aspects, we might envision in the future being able to build our own sort of infrastructure, our own funding base, our own platform, then running as different types of Democrats, running as basically mm-hmm. left Democrats or socialist Democrats or whatnot as a tactical decision at the local level. I think it's all when all possible, it's preferred to do that through a third party. But the key is these parties are structured in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also not to say that creating a third party is simply a matter of closing your eyes and making a choice. It's not a matter of just saying, right. All right, we all need to summon the moral will and the courage
yes.
to vote
right.
for Jill Stein.
Right.
I don't think that's how we would build a third party. And the way that I see it is this. The way forward for a third party, which is something I desperately want to see in this country within my lifetime, within the next couple of decades,
mm-hmm.
is we do this through building our social movements, building our struggles from below, and building radical currents within the labor movement until we have enough of a base and enough activity that we could actually say plausibly, maybe not at the presidential level, but at least to begin with the local and state level, say plausibly, we can go ahead and run a competitive race and convince people that we have a shot to win. And in the meantime, that'll probably be at the local level. I think in a place in New York City, we can run left city council candidates. We can run state Senate candidates that could credibly have a chance to win.
And that's
in Chicago, you can,
Absolutely. And that's the other really important part of this conversation because people, I want to get specifically to critiquing the moralism because I think it's not only is it frustrating, but it's also, in my view, just a really, really, really diluted way of kind of processing politics in a certain way. But, when we say local organizing or start from local infrastructures, first of all, and I apologize to use this language, but number one, that's where the market opportunity is. In a place like New York City, it is essentially a one-party city. It's a one-party city that, just as we've said before, it's the kind of microcosm example. It needs to represent, all sorts of public workers and public unions and various social movements to the extent that they're still active in New York City. And then, the people that run the place, real estate developers, finance, like the real centers of power in New York City. And so you have a great example of a guy like Bill de Blasio, who really, he is a liberal with the promises and the limits of that. Again, he might have problems just as a politician and his operating style, which I think are real, and that's kind of another issue. But you see it. You see the policy proposals. You see we're going to give developers a lot of what they want, and we're going to kind of try to put in some safety brakes on this. It's better than Bloomberg. It's better than Giuliani. But there's real limits to it. So that's where a market opportunity is, New York, Chicago. And then to the extent that we've actually seen this happen, and I'm not, idolizing the progressives in Vermont, but, they have done that to an extent, and maybe they've been compromised by, cross-endorsing Democrats, and, obviously Bernie seems to have, he's supportive of them on a local level, but he has a kind of ambivalent relationship to them. But the reality is that starting with Bernie Sanders and through Bernie Sanders, there's one place in the country that consistently has a left-of-center party represented in state legislature, city council, and that is the progressives in Vermont. And they did it by running against establishment Democrats on local levels. That's the formula. So we have market opportunity, and then we have the only proven way of actually doing this.
Then you also have the Working Families Party here in New York, where you could say that they completely messed up partially because of how bad the labor movement is in the U.S. And right. particularly in New York, how bureaucratic some of these big unions are, and the fact that they were pressured into supporting Cuomo and whatnot. But you could say the actual structure and the actual theory of what they were doing was, you know, a little bit off, but generally had the right idea,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So you
mm-hmm.
can imagine what would a Working Families Party effort look like if we actually had a militant, rank-and-file driven labor movement in the U.S., which isn't that hard to imagine us developing that, right? So I think in many ways that's one pathway towards a new party. I don't mm-hmm. think it comes from every 4 years running a 1-2% candidate against a Democrat. I think it comes from creating breaks and fissures where you are. I don't think it's completely counterposed. I think that the ultimate effort of those, for example, coming out of the Sanders movement that are moving in a different direction than myself, for example, that are want to create a Tea Party of the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. I think their efforts will ultimately be futile, right? I don't mm-hmm. think they'll work. But I think in the process, they might come to discover that, or they might open up new fissures and divides in the Democratic Party. But no doubt, any future effort is going to need them. It's going to need a lot more people than that. It's going to need people involved in social movements like Black Lives Matter,
right.
like Fight for 15. So I think, in other words, it's a complex process. It'll come from like simmering social movements, social conflict, lots of these different efforts, lots of these, and it might at times require tactically taking on certain Democrats, but not every Democrat, right? Like, for example, mm-hmm. in a city with 20 city council races, you might run against the five worst to begin with, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's this very moral idea that one can't separate strategic and tactical decisions. Like, for example,
right.
supporting, registering as a Democrat to vote for Bernie Sanders, to me, that was a very easy thing to do.
Yeah,
and I was
course.
Happy to be able to do it, and that was a tactical decision,
yeah,
right?
Of course, right.
But for a lot of people, they're like, no, morally, I can't become a member of a so-compromised political party. That, to me, is politics as narcissism as politics, you know?
Right, right. It's a sort of, I mean, and look, to be really clear, of course there is morality. Like, the reason that you do politics from a left perspective, I mean, I'll get really soft for a minute. It is that Che quote. There is a feeling of love, right? I mean, to paraphrase it, you have a desire
right.
for justice and for the betterment of overall human experience. That in a kind of clean version is, I think, one of the highest, you know, moral expressions available to humans. That's very important. But as you sort of move into the terrain of getting like dirt under your nails, like you can't, you know, if you want to go join like these noble, you know, like older Quaker folks doing a vigil in front of a prison because they, or, you know, or a vigil about U.S. imperialism because they've been doing it for decades and they kind of go there and they register, you know, rain or shine, their kind of moral calling. I think one can have a great deal of respect for that and, you know, and be in solidarity with that. But as soon as you're talking about voting and the electoral game, it is not about your personal feelings in terms of, you know, what you feel about how you do it. And the important distinction I think you're raising, though, is it's not just that version and like the kind of limited version that I would say, which is like, look, I mean, and going back, I think even though the Democratic Party and the Labor Party are very different, we can still register that, like, look, if Donald Trump wins, that is a cultural acknowledgement that has been validated by a presidential win that racism, that misogyny, that all of the social groupings that he has attacked is acceptable on the way forward. Now, Hillary Clinton is, like her or not, and many don't, and I will confess, I find some of the I'm by no means a fan of Hillary Clinton, but some of the personalization of it gets sort of annoying and counterproductive at a certain point. But, you know, if she culturally represents, you know, just by voting blocks, like a Hispanic Union member, well, registering culturally that the Hispanic Union member has won and the racist has lost is actually important. because it reverberates in terms of what type of pressure she's susceptible to versus what kind of pressure he's susceptible to, which is why we have to look at it in a structural way. But sorry to digress, but the second point that you were making that I think is very important is that in addition to this kind of moralism being a problem and this kind of limited short-term choice of just like, you know, sorry, the reality is that there are two choices available. And if you're voting in a state where it actually matters, it sort of matters, I think, to vote for the, you know, the less problematic choice. But the second point is that even strategically, decades out in the long term, this kind of just exercise of your personal truth through voting is also absolutely not the path that is going to get us viable socialist alternatives.
Right, absolutely. But here's one key distinction. I think that for sure we could say we'd rather be under a Clinton in opposition fighting Clinton than in opposition fighting Trump. Because we could say, listen, you voted for her because you wanted these things, and this was in the platform, but they're doing none of this. And if there's a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president, I think that gives us more room on the left to build those movements and not have those movements be collapsed into a, hey, let's get Trump out, let's elect anyone but Trump kind of
that's
thing.
That's Bush, but, the Bush era.
Right, exactly. But my case, actually, I personally will vote for Jill Stein and will not vote for Hillary Clinton. But I'll couch my argument on strategic grounds, right? One of them is that I actually do think that Hillary Clinton has a fairly sizable lead. I think that the left cannot swing this election either way. I think that does matter to me from a strategic standpoint.
Right.
I think that what is the most important thing for me politically is to maintain and build this kind of separation that emerged during the primary between the Sanders Democrats and the Clinton Democrats. I'm not talking about Clinton voters and Sanders voters. I'm talking about what Sandersism represents and what Clintonism represents. Basically, this idea that there is something left of liberalism. People weren't calling it social democracy, but it, you know, it's something like that, right? And I think if we just call on people to dissolve their identity and their sense of you know, Clinton's part of the establishment, and look at all these things the Clintons have done, and look at who's in their inner circle, and look how things will be. We're just going to disarm ourselves for when, you know, she's actually president. So I think especially in a state like New York, it's a no-brainer, you know. But even if I was in a swing state, I don't think I would support Hillary Clinton. And at the very least, even if I thought that I need to vote for Hillary Clinton, I certainly wouldn't campaign for her. Right. So maybe there's a way to do anti-Trump campaigning in it, that you could maintain your independence from the Clinton campaign. You know, I think that would be a path. But in other words, I think there is a distinction between those types of rough arguments that I'm making right now and just saying, hey, listen, I there's no choice for me because I personally can't touch her. I personally can't do this. Or I,
that type
know,
of nuance kind of very would not fly on the McLaughlin report, Bhaskar.
Right.
Yeah. Wrong.
Right.
No, but I see. I mean, I think I take your point, but I think that I find even that I don't agree with it necessarily, because I do think that there is a sharp distinction even just on that cultural realm that matters, and it matters if you're in a swing state. But I think that that reasoning is not a problem to me at all. The reasoning that, like, I just can't get my personal hands dirty because it doesn't feel good to me is a major problem.
Right.
I mean, even beyond this election.
It's a bad sign. It's a bad sign if we want to train people. Sounds kind of authoritarian. I don't mean it that way. But if we want to create an environment where people are learning politics and taking all sorts of sides but taking debates, we on the left need to learn how to have those debates in a serious way, right? So one thing, you know, not to digress, but one thing real quick is that I'll give you one example. Let's say if me and you are talking, right? And you say something that I find in some way offensive, right? Not that you would, but let's say you do. Now, I feel like throughout a lot of left history, throughout a lot of history of the socialist movement, the way this would be handled would be, all right, you know, let's sit down and be like, you know, let's mention it and let's basically say, all right, me and you are having a conversation because we share the same political beliefs, because we have the same aspirations for a better world. Right. You say something, so I'm going to assume good faith and hopefully you'll correct it. Then if it becomes a problem, then maybe at some point we just denounce you, right?
Right.
But right now, the mentality, I think, especially among a lot of campus-based activism and whatnot, is
yes.
you look for any
right.
any divergence, any sign of whatever. So it's this extreme like sense of, I think, individual aggrievement instead
yes.
of collective politics.
Definitely.
And obviously, one can create you know, spaces on the left that are completely, you know, sensitive to different concerns and whatnot. But I think tone and tenor, right,
mm-hmm.
of avoiding moralism in politics, I think actually, you know, it does matter as far as organizing. You know, it does really, you know, I think it has weakened us losing some of these things and this mentality over the past, you know, couple, you know, decades.
Well, and I also think as a final point, I would like your thought on this as well. I think that that aspect is also in some ways, and in its worst, is also just an expression of the kind of marketization of everything, because it's kind of like there isn't a collective aspect to it. It's just sort of like, and if it's about a certain type of emotional reactions, then I don't know if the, you know, the politics that can actually be covered by that are, they can actually be appeased in fairly limited ways. You know, like corporate America, and it's a good thing, but it can respond to those types of demands. I don't think it can respond to, you know, a durable safety net or real wages or, you know, questioning the means of ownership and how business should even operate. So it can kind of also, in addition to alienating people, can close the door to some of the higher stakes that we need to deal with.
Right, absolutely. So capitalists right now are fine with allowing, you know, gender-neutral bathrooms, right? Yeah. What they're not fine with is actually opening up and investing in new shelters and new social safety
right.
nets to help a young trans kid.
Exactly.
So sometimes on the left, we can go to the other extreme and say, oh, this stuff doesn't matter. This stuff is a distraction. No, it's not a distraction.
No, it's central.
But all these struggles... Yeah. All these struggles against different oppressions need to flow through some type of workers' movements, need to flow through some sort of broader class framework. Otherwise, we our struggles at best, even when we win these struggles against oppression, they become struggles for a symbolic representation and not actually for the things that will improve the lives of these struggling people.
Well, Bhaskar Sankara, my comrade, hashtag TriniKami, let's get it trending. I appreciate your time, man.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
All right. Always. Talk to you soon. Okay, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I saw Drake in L.A. and other people. It was a very... Yeah, there's a problem with this phone line. The IMs are open. There's plenty of stories to get to. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Subscribe to us on iTunes if you haven't already. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast on iTunes. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Tea Coffee or Chocolate, all that good stuff. See you on the flip side.